Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Toro. Golfers get custom fit clubs for longer, straighter shots. Now, using the adjustable technology on Toro's new Greensmaster 1000 Series Walk Green Mower, superintendents can dial in operator performance for precise, consistent cuts. The Greensmaster's telescoping handle has five different positions, so the operator's posture will be as perfect as a tour pro's, whether he's tall and skinny or short and husky. And the handle's rubber mounts have just enough cushion to prevent any hand movements from influencing the cut. Sounds like Toro's solved the mower yips. Maybe they can fix the putting yips next. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo today. We are back with another edition of our superintendent series. Today, I am joined by Mountain Lakes Director of Grounds, Tony Nice. Tony is a longtime superintendent, ton of experience working at a lot of great clubs in the Southeast, such as Long Cove, Pine Tree, most recently Old Marsh, and now he just accepted the, and he just got the job up at Mountain Lake this year. So Tony joined me. He's a big architecture nut, was actually involved with Friars Head's construction crew as a college intern. And so we talked all across the board about, you know, everything from architecture to maintenance. So without further ado, here's Tony Nice.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
On that, they went last year for the first time on that golf trip, and they're going back this year. They like love it. They think it's like the best golf. I think it's like probably one of the best affordable golf trips you can.
You can do. It's awesome. And my last day in Michigan, I watched my brother play a high school basketball game at my high school that I went to. And my dad said, hey, I need you to meet somebody before you leave. He's thinking about building a golf course and just wants some thoughts on two architects. So I'm like, all right. So that's right up my alley. I walk across the floor, and a gentleman says, hey, you know, my name is so-and-so, and I'm thinking about building a golf course. He says, I'm looking at Jerry Matthews, and I'm looking at Mike DeVries. And I'm like, oh man. Okay. I said, you know, Jerry's kind of generic. I said, there's a lot of Jerry's in Michigan. I said, you're going to get a safe design. You're going to get something that is going to appeal to a certain level of people, and probably going to get something that, you know, not going to cause too much ripples. I says, but Mike's going to do something really cool. That's just who he is. He's going to shape bunkers and greens. And I says, he's just going to do something really cool that is probably going to, you know, garner attention that you want, especially at a public golf course, and, you know, something really unique. And I gave him some examples of Diamond Springs and Pilgrim's Run and stuff. And not say I had anything to do with it, but he ended up hiring Mike. And man, I think the Mines was top five best new affordable when it opened in 06 or something like that. And, long story short, my dad ends, Chris Shoemaker, who helped develop Pilgrim's Run, came over from Diamond Springs and became the superintendent at the Mines. And then my dad went to work at the Mines and still works there 30, 35 hours a week. And it, you know, the Mines actually, when I was in elementary school, and so like take class trips on the Mines and walk and learn about the gypsum deposits that were put in there. So it's kind of a cool little full circle thing that over the 40 years, almost 40 years I've been on this earth to kind of see come to fruition. Pretty cool.
The Mines is an incredible spot. It's
awesome spot.
And I mean, it's 5 minutes from downtown Grand Rapids.
It is. And you would never, and it doesn't feel like Grand Rapids. You don't hear the highway really, other than when a little bit by number six, I think it is. And it, you know, it just, they hit a home run there. They're always sold out. They got great clientele. It's a good architectural design for what, $40-$50. And if you want to do that whole DeVries trip, like you were just explaining, you can do it on a weekend and probably for about, what, $200 or something, $250, play three really good golf courses.
Yeah, yeah. From a maintenance standpoint, I love, and I can't, I've probably talked about it 100 times on this podcast, but Diamond Springs to me, with just the single mow, you know, big gang mowers out there and right into the greens. And then, you know, the single row irrigation is like, that is what public affordable golf should be. It's just, you know, you could tell that they can maintain that thing on a tight budget. And it's, you know, the native is some of the best native I've ever played out of.
Sure. And they're the cool thing there is, they've never tried to be someone they're not at Diamond Springs. I had a chance. I played with Greg Johnson, who used to write for the Grand Rapids Press on opening day there. And I remember during the grow-in that Chris Shoemaker, who I mentioned earlier, he was asking around for park masters, and nobody could figure it out. You know, this was right at the time when all these lightweight fairway mowers were coming out, and he, you know, he's going around and piecing one park master together with another park master to mow all these areas all at one height. And he was, you know, the only one at the time that was going that direction. And all the tees are mowed at one height. All the rough is what, you know, it's kind of like Augusta that way. There's just all one cut throughout. And I don't know what they mow with now, but I would much different.
Yeah, the last five holes are just incredible out there too. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first five are incredible because they got the great green complex. I mean, that's just an amazing golf course. So you're talking about, you know, giving architect advice. You were in high school or were you in college at that point?
I was 21, getting ready to leave for an assistance job at Long Cove. And I had spent, I was one of the first GCA guys actually way back in the day. And so I remember I was in my dorm room at Michigan State, and I had an internship already lined up with Mark Michaud at Shinnecock. And I get this call from a 561 number. And I'm like, you know, cell phones back in the day. I'm like, do I want to answer this? Is it going to take up my minutes? Am I roaming? All that stuff.
Was it one of the Motorola StarTech roamer?
Yeah,
the flip
phones? It was. And then I'm just like, oh man, I'm a college kid, and my first semester of college, I had a girlfriend at the time, you know, we were in love, and so we talked on the phone, and I had like a $300 cell phone bill that my parents just raked me over the coals on. So it was like shortly after that. So I was really hesitant to answer a phone call. And it ended with Kenny Batts. And he got my number through Golf Club Atlas and says, hey, I'm building a golf course, and I'm looking for interns, and I think, you know, we have an opportunity here to show you, you know, some of the things that you talk about on Golf Club Atlas that you want to see. And I'd mentioned that I already had an internship lined up, but it intrigued me enough because I was into that. I used to draw golf holes on my church bulletins growing up. And my bunkering at the time was much more like Reese Jones when I look back on it. But
If I could find my early designs, they were extraordinarily penal. You know, like when I was a kid, I would draw just these ridiculous holes with water everywhere.
You know, it's funny. I'm still kind of bitter because I remember after I get an opportunity to go to Friar's Head. I call up Mark Michaud, and who was the superintendent at the time at Shinnecock, and I tell him about it, and he says, "Oh, that's going to be a really good one."
And you were supposed to work there.
I was supposed to do a top 10 golf course maintenance wise, you know, maintain grass, learn about fertility and cultural practices. And I just kind of felt that that's always going to be there. And this is a once in a lifetime chance to build a golf course. I can always go back in the turf because that's what I'm studying to do. And my professor at Michigan State kind of fought me on it because he had never played Shinnecock. And so he wanted an opportunity to go out there and play golf during the internship.
What so a selfish guy.
Yeah, I'm like, come on. And I stuck my heels in a little bit, as much as I could, as a 20-year-old, 19, 20-year-old, and spent 2 summers out at Friar's Head. And I worked with Chris Hunt, who went on in the architectural field for quite a while. Did a bunch of work with Tom Doak. And so I've never seen Friar's Head in person.
Really?
In an open position. I left about 3 or 4 weeks before it actually opened. So we did a lot of bunker work there. We did a lot of greens tie-ins. You know, the 16th green, Chris and I spent about 2 weeks on. You know, it's 3,000 square feet, 3,200 square feet. And Bill Coor wanted, you know, he wanted eight pinning locations on there. And we got it pretty close to where he wanted it. And we took about a 3-inch rain in an hour, and it washed it all out down to the left into that swale and everything. And so I spent a lot of time just doing that detail stuff work. We worked a lot with Jeff working on bunker work there. And the chunking, you know, a lot of the chunks for Friar's Head's bunkers at the time came from that big field to the left, to the west of the hole there. And just really going through it. I remember he gave me a paint gun, and the first couple bunkers I painted for cutting in were the right fairway bunkers on 13, and he scratched them out and he says, we're not doing Reese Jones stuff. I remember it like it was yesterday. And I just kind of laughed but it was a credible experience. I remember Bill Coor commenting that was going to be a property that would always need some tweaking because it moves, you know, the dunes when you get up to 14, 15, 16, move with the wind every year, and how the golf course would always need some subtle adjustments. And, nature would really be, you know, dictating that golf course. And it, you know, the pictures I've seen now don't look anything like when I left it almost 20 years ago now. And it's gorgeous now. All the tees were originally squared off tees, and now they're all tie-ins to the shortcuts around the greens, and real free flowing now. And it's aged very, very well. Looks fantastic. One day I'll get back up there and see the place.
That's something that I think's crazy about the architecture world, is how many guys that work on these projects never see the finished or the mature product.
They don't. And, you know, you have guys like, you know, Tom Doak still goes around and visits a lot of his places. And, you know, you hear, you know, stories of some of the architects now, they go back to visit because they're brought back in to change something, or it's been 15 years and they want to make some adjustments and stuff. And it goes to show how busy some of those guys are, that they just can't do that free for all traveling, where, you know, Brian just traveled the Midwest here. I think Tom just traveled the Midwest, seeing all these golf courses. It's just kind of unheard of because they just don't have the ability to do a lot of that stuff because they're so busy.
In terms of that experience as a, you know, going and doing the construction crew stuff as an intern, how do you think that experience helped you down the road versus doing the standard internship?
I think that it gave me a different appreciation for architecture. I kind of fell into architecture in my enjoyment for it, not necessarily intentionally. I used to collect a lot of scorecards and just kind of observe the differences in golf courses. And I thought I really want to go in the architectural field for a while, and travel and build and all that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, I've been afforded some opportunities to work on some golf courses with architectural merit, one way or another. And I think I've been more selective in where I've had the opportunity to work because of it. I've always wanted to work at a golf course that you know, is not just greatly, you know, really well maintained, but that just has some sort of architectural history or merit, or maybe it was cutting edge at the time. You know, being at Pine Tree, that's, many consider that to be Wilson's greatest golf course. And Pine Tree is just pure golf, and you stand on the sixth hole there, and you can see seven holes on the front side. And it's a lot of golf courses aren't built that way anymore. And it's just Long Cove is just so far different than Harbortown, even though they were 3 miles up the road, and that Pete built it right after TPC. And you couldn't have two more different golf courses built by the same architect in the same window. Just some really cool stuff that I picked up along the way, just kind of understanding and liking and enjoying architecture, being a little more selective, I guess, or certainly enjoying, you know, trying to change, you know, fairway mowing lines and tie-ins and certain things like that, because I think I had a good eye for that kind of stuff.
Yeah. When you were a kid, you obviously, with your dad in the industry, I imagine that played a big role in you getting out and being on a golf course all the time. Was there a moment where you caught the architecture bug, or was it just the thing that, you know, you like to draw golf holes as a kid and it grew from there?
Well, I was always interested. According to my parents, the golf course my dad was at, they built 9 holes extra when they put some condos on the golf course. And my mom tells me as a kid that she used to just take me to the golf course, and we would sit in the car and watch the bulldozers and the dump trucks and the excavators just go. And still this day, if there's construction on the highway, I'm rubbernecking, because I want to see, if is that a 330, is that a 307, is that a D6? And, it just kind of hit me, the fact that I could enjoy seeing construction and be on a golf course at the same time was just an epiphany to me. Like, it was awesome. And I certainly couldn't, I remember the first time I got on a bulldozer and trying to figure out, how do you operate this? There's no steering wheel here. How do you possibly operate this thing? So I just kind of enjoyed construction and machinery, and it just kind of led into architecture and having an enjoyment of kind of putting the two together.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think, like, just being around the game as a kid is half the battle, because leads to a rapid development of the golf brain, you know?
100%.
So with you get into the industry. Your first job was at Long Cove, correct?
My first job out of school, other than just kind of wrapping up the assistant job, I was an assistant at a course up the street that my dad worked at, just a nice little country club, for about 6 months before the position at Long Cove opened up. My other college roommate, I had three college roommates. One was Kyle Hagelin of Sand Hills, and another one, his name was Brian Brace, and I don't believe he's in the business anymore, but he was from Buford, South Carolina. So I went on spring break with him once to play golf down there, and we went to Hilton Head and Savannah, Charleston, and I remember crossing, seeing the front entrance of Long Cove and thinking, I want to work there someday. And I remember when the job came available, and I enjoyed my time in the low country. I spent about 4 years at Long Cove, from 03 to 07. And a new superintendent, Ashley Davis, who's still there, I was his hire. I was a damn Yankee compared to him. I was uptight. I was not from South Carolina, so I was a little more, not as laid back as maybe Ashley liked to be, but developed a really good internship program there. And basically, you do an internship there, he just keeps inviting guys back to work for him. It's been a long lineage of good assistants that have come through there that have moved on to good superintendent jobs throughout the Southeast and even into Texas a little bit. And guys that have been successful and worked their way up to become CGCSs and volunteer on the board of Georgia and South Carolina for the Carolinas chapters and stuff like that. And Ashley's done a really good job there for, coming up on 20 years now.
Yeah, so Long Cove, you also worked at another dive course, Old Marsh. That was your latest position before you took the job at Mountain Lake. Contrast, I think this is, you know, and you hit on it a little bit with the stadium course and Harbortown, how unique and different each of those properties were for Dye's, you know, in Dye's portfolio.
Sure. Yeah, in third, fourth grade, when I started collecting scorecards, I remember Lynx Magazine had just come out, and they were, you know, giving out free magazines to everyone to help build up their image and get the word out. And I remember seeing the sixth hole in an advertisement from Old Marsh. And I wrote them, and they sent a scorecard and a video and a brochure and all that stuff. And it always had an idea, always wanted to see Old Marsh. And I interviewed there the season before Long Cove, and I turned it down as an assistant because they still had bent grass there. And oh my gosh, they had G2 bent grass, which in hindsight was probably only fun for about 3 months out of the year. And it was just, it had to be a slog after that. So blazing hot, and in a marsh where water levels are high, and you know, in the summertime, stagnant humidity. And so I always had it on my radar. And drastically different golf course. Much Old Marsh is much more in line with, you know, TPC than Long Cove was. Much more like Harbortown than Long Cove was. You know, smaller greens, smaller targets, a lot more, you know, water that is in play as opposed to kind of parallel to play. And so I when that position came open, I had been at Pine Tree for almost 6 years at that time. And, just looking for a new challenge. They were getting ready to do a renovation, and, they offered me the position, and pretty much my first week there, they said, "Hey, we're renovating in 11 months. We don't have one contract signed." And, you know, they were working with Chris Lutzky, who Chris, a Dye protege, that was Chris's first job back in 86, 87. So Chris did a lot of the shaping. We had the whole property GPSed by Scott Poole down to the 10th of an inch. The goal of that project was to not change the golf course, but because the county changed the water levels in the property, it caused half inch rain, drains would fill up with water, bunkers would have water in them. So the property didn't drain like Pete originally designed it. So we ended up bringing in 3,700 dump trucks load worth of fill to essentially raise the whole property out of the marsh line, a minimum of, I think it was 2.5 feet. So that all the drain lines were out of the waterways, and that unless the county decided to change the water levels again, the golf course, now it wouldn't play fast and firm all the time, there wouldn't be standing water in fairways and standing water in waste bunkers and stuff like that. And so if you played Old Marsh prior to 2015 and then played it after 2016, you'd hardly know the golf course was redone.
Talk about a crazy project.
Yes, it was. You know, they talked about putting drainage in with a massive, like 30 different pumps to pump water around the property. And it was just kind of agreed that even if the water levels are high and all these pumps worked, you're just moving water from one spot to the next. And, you know, the Old Marsh was designed for, you know, I remember Pete was on the sixth fairway. It was one of the last times he was there, and he saw how many people were playing the golf course and just couldn't believe how much golf was out there. You know, it was designed for 60, 70 rounds a day, and it was doing twice that. So the golf course, the usage of the golf course changed in the 25 years, 30 years between building and the renovation, that, you know, having 2 or 3 days being walking only in the middle of the heart of your season because you didn't have cart paths and water levels were high, it just wasn't an option anymore. So, I mean, we changed a little bit of the sixth green. We changed the ninth green a little bit. And we added a pin on 16. That was it.
The six hole is the blind one, right?
The fifth hole is the blind one.
I remember that. I played that course over 10 years ago now. I just remember that hole. That is a neat hole.
Very kind. You know, it's similar to the fifth at Long Cove. And it was like the old 12th at TPC. It was just kind of an era that Pete was in, you know, that I think PGA West has one too. I could be wrong on that. But there's three or four, the original Ford plantation that he built in 88, the fifth hole there was a blind par four as well, short. And there was talk during the renovation about putting a tee on there and back farther kind of by the fourth green. And I remember Pete just saying that wasn't the intention of the hole. It was supposed to be blind. You're supposed to hit a 7, 8, 9 iron into it. And you know, the closer you hit to the right along the waterway, the better opportunity you have to see the green. And it's still, you know, when I left, it was still controversy. The ongoing joke was if we ever ran out of fill on the golf course, we'd just dig up the big mound there on 5 and fill a fairway in with it and raise the fairway up.
So talk us through a little bit like the process of, you know, you laser it, and then how do you guys rebuild a golf course to exactly spec?
So Scott Poole, for those that don't know Scott Poole, Scott has actually won some awards for his GPS technology. He typically, you know, he worked with Wingfoot doing all their greens here in the last couple of years of shooting them to the grades, and then they rebuilt the greens and put all the grades back. He does a lot of stuff with Augusta, making sure all those grades go exactly back to where they were original before the reconstruction. So Scott was actually on the crew at Old Marsh originally as well, back in 86, 87. So it's kind of a labor of love for him to come back. So he sets up his beacons, and he started on the first hole and shot the whole thing. I think everything was in 20-yard increments. 25-yard increments. The greens were a little bit tighter. It took him about 4 weeks to shoot the whole golf course. And so all that data that he saved went into a file that was downloaded on the track on the bulldozers. So the property level, the waterways were 16 feet, 6 inches is where the water was. And we had it in our heads that a minimum, I think it was 17 and a half feet, is what the minimum would be outside when the pumps would kick on in the property. And so there was a beacon up by the ninth green up on a hill there, and all that information would go into the bulldozers, and the blade on the dozer would move. You just had to sit in it. So we actually had an assistant that would sit in the thing 2, 3, 4 hours a day, and just as dump trucks would come in, just pushing piles out, knowing they weren't making cuts or anything like that. But the blade would just move along with the level of the GPS. Almost to the T, all the little fairway contours were put back. So there's 800 drains in the fairways at Old Marsh, and every drain got a riser put on it and got cut off, and all the material got worked back to the drains. So the drains lines were all cleaned out, but the fairway contouring and the subtleness and the low profile of Old Marsh to kind of fit, you know, the surrounds was all put back. If a fairway raised up a foot, a tee got raised up a foot. If a fairway was raised up a foot, the green was raised up a foot. The bunker floors were raised up a foot. All the mounding was raised a foot. I mean, it is almost identical to what was original. It just sits basically somewhere between 2 and 3 feet higher than what it did in 86, 87.
With the courses down there, obviously there's not a ton of topographical movement that helps move water, you know, mm-hmm. whether it be at Pine Tree or Old Marsh. And, you know, obviously Marsh, Old Marsh, as the name would suggest, is sitting in a marsh. How, you know, is drainage kind of like an ongoing challenge as a superintendent day to day?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when we first opened up Old Marsh the second time, so after the renovation, you know, there was the misconception of, well, we're going to play fast and firm all the time, even if it rains. Well, you're still draining into a marsh. And if that marsh is high, the water is only going to go so far. And we always, the ongoing joke was, it's not called Old Hills Golf Club. It's Old Marsh. We're down in a marsh, whether we like it or not. You know, being here at Mountain Lake, I can count on one hand how many drains we have in a fairway, and everything perches and drains. We drain infinitely better than what we did, when I was at Old Marsh. But old marsh and pine trees, so you're always just trying to move water because, you know, generally South Florida is relatively flat. And, you know, if the marshes are high, the golf course is going to play softer. And if the marshes are low, the water's got a place to go and you can drain quicker. But I don't know if fast and firm, other than certain specific times a year, the consistency of fast and firm for 12 months will ever be good in South Florida, if you will, which is good and bad. I think a lot of the people that play in South Florida, the members and people that come down for the seasonal stuff, get the best of the crop, if you will. But if you're not putting drainage in South Florida in the summertime, you're probably falling behind. It's just, it is what it is.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor, Toro. Those big agricultural tractors you see working on golf courses, with their clutch and complicated lever pulling sequences in a turf maintenance application, they're like stepping onto the first tee, not knowing which swing you have that day. Toro's new Outcross 9060 can do everything those clunky tractors can, but with tons less stress on the operator and on the turf. With the automotive controls and programmable attachment parameters, even rookies on the crew can be trusted with aerating, top dressing, mowing grass, loading sand, and removing snow from around the clubhouse in the winter. The Toro Outcross 9060 is like having all of your best golf shots saved, ready for use each and every round. Follow @ToroGolf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. Now back to Tony Nice. So, yeah, that's going to be one of my questions, is it, working at clubs that are predominantly winter clubs, what does summer look like for you, like right now at a Mountain Lake?
So we are just started our fourth greens aerification since I've been here. We pretty much we're closing 9 holes every 2 weeks and aerifying everything. Excess thatch, if you will. It's 2 to 8 rounds a day right now, so having 9 holes open isn't that big of a deal. But some of it's just about understanding, you know, I think there's going to be a time where some of the South Florida golf courses have to, you know, members are staying down there. And with this whole COVID thing, I think everybody seemed to see their golf season last a little bit longer, and it'll be interesting to see if it starts a little bit earlier. And so, you know, when the deadline in South Florida was always November 1, you got to be ready and you got to have all the pine straw beds cleaned up and your greens heights where they got to be. And, you know, sometimes November is not the easiest of months, cause it's still mid to high 80s sometimes the first couple of weeks of November. And, you know, you get members that come down that have been playing on the bent POAs of the north that don't even grow during the day, and they're running 13 at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they come down to South Florida and it's like, greens are slow. they're 12, but they're growing during the day, you know? But it's interesting, I was at between Pine Tree and Old Marsh 11 years, and just seeing how the tolerance to play when it's hot was okay. They play in the morning, but they still, you know, a lot of people, members, whether they play year round or whether they are seasonal, they still want it to be presented well. And so how you juggle that aerification program to ensure the longevity of a golf course, is becoming, an interesting topic. You know, the heel time of a big core aerification is probably 3 weeks. And you do that once or twice, or, you know, 2.5 times, if you will, in a summertime, and it eats up, you know, 3 to 4 months of the summer pretty quickly. And there's a couple different things that a lot of clubs are diving into. The dry jet process is fantastic to really pack that profile full of sand, and but it doesn't remove organic, and we, you know, we grow grass and grow organic material 10 to 12 months out of the year, depending on where you are in Florida. And, you know, you don't want to turn customers away. You don't want to, you know, tell your membership that, you know, we just aerified last week and the greens are bumpy, they're slow. And, you know, a lot of the members that come down don't see all that stuff that happens in the Northeast. You know, when they come down in mid-October and everyone in the Northeast starts aerifying, they don't see that portion of it. So it's something I think they got to understand what the goal is and when you want to be your best condition. And even though you grow grass 12 months out of the year, it's just not feasible to be conditioned 12 months out of the year, 10 months out of the year. You got to have that downtime to poke some holes and rip up the Bermuda grass. I mean, a lot of guys, you see, they take that Bermuda grass down to dirt. Literally down to dirt. It's impressive.
With the big aerification, the big core, what you touched on with the dry jack, you're not getting to the organic matter or the thatch, and that I've recently talked to some people, and just the, you know, the idea of you could have a great stretch of weather, but if your course has all that organic matter, that thatch, it's still not going to play firm and fast like the course that doesn't have that thatch, right?
Correct. Yep.
So yeah, and you're doing a big project that's going to ensure when you're at your best is better than what it would be without that, right?
Correct. And you know, the thing that we face in Florida is that, you know, our busy season in Florida, let's say it's November to mid-April. Well, November, December, and even part of January are very, you know, the sun's up by 7:30 to 8 o'clock and it's dark by 5:30. And so, you know, you can do the numbers right there, and that's 9, maybe 10 hours of daylight, but it's not drying daylight. It's not, you know, you're not going to dry out because of one day in the sun. That sun level is so low that while it's light out, it doesn't dry anything down. So, you know, thatch can be extremely detrimental to turf in Florida in the winter months because we just don't dry down, but yet that's the busiest time of year for us. So the expectations are high, you know, green speeds, they want them A, B, C, or D. But if you get damaged from it, you're just not growing enough to really heal out of anything. Unless you're overseeded, there's a little bit more you can do. But, you know, there's a lot of ways to get around that now. But, you know, you get damaged in this November and December or January even, and you're not going to really start healing out of it till March 1 maybe is kind of the time. So trying to get as much organic and thatch matter out of the top of all your surfaces, especially greens, is only going to help them dry down a little bit quicker than if they had to do it on their own. Cause it just doesn't dry down. Like, a 75 degree day is not, you're not going to all of a sudden be grabbing hoses and touching everything up at the end of the day. It just doesn't dry down like a sunny warm day might do. Cause I mean, there's days where you don't see the sun hardly get above the tree lines. And it's just what it is.
And those are the busiest days of traffic for Florida, yeah, too.
Yeah, 100%. And it'll be interesting, you know, with the COVID thing, do more people come to Florida because at least we can get outside? You know, you can get outside and golf here. You're not going to do that in Michigan where my family's from. You're not going to do it in Chicago. And so do you have more down here? And then, are the rounds of golf higher? So what you're used to for rounds of golf, are they higher? Are we having to be a little more cautious maybe in the amount that we roll and the heights of cuts that we play with to get to our speeds? I mean, it's going to be an interesting season for that because, what we've known to come and to position the turf for, you know, there's a lot of golf courses doing record numbers in the Northeast right now and in the Midwest. Just, astronomical numbers. Does that follow down here? You almost have to believe it does.
Yeah, double rounds of years before, clubs that saw 8,000 rounds are going to see 20,000 rounds this year. Public golf courses, I'm speaking from experience with my buddies. If you don't book a time early in the week, you're not getting one on the weekend until 4 or 5 p.m. And, it's a great thing. But the other aspect of it is also for you guys managing your workforce, at a time where you have to be extremely careful and you're dealing with more play than you've ever dealt with.
Well, and you're not going to turn anybody away to play golf. I mean, the one good thing, and hopefully some of the associations that golf course superintendents work with can promote this, but I think it's been very loud and clear what the number one asset at a club is. It's the golf course, and people are enjoying it. And when the golf courses are busy, because that's giving people something to do, I think it's a fantastic thing. And, some guys get bent out of shape over some of the little things about golfers etiquette right now and stuff. And I always remind my staff about how that kind of stuff affords us the new equipment or a pay raise or another staff member or all those things. And it is what it is. And we have to adjust too. We have to be open-minded to things because, it's a different world and we just have to be very diligent and vigilant at the same time. It's what we know in the turf world and how we go about things. We clean our equipment twice a day right now. We clean door handles in the maintenance facility before lunch and after lunch and at the end of the day. And it's just all these little things that, we have to protect our staff, because if we don't have the staff, we're not going to be able to even make a dent in what they want to see on the golf course. I think being here at Mountain Lake, I think our rounds will be similar just because it's a quieter club to begin with. But I think Florida is going to be a busy epic center for golf this coming winter, which is a good thing for South Florida and Central Florida.
Talk about what excited you. You made the switch to Mountain Lake this spring, right kind of when the world was, changing. Talk about what excited you about making the move from Old Marsh up to Mountain Lake.
So when I was at Friar's Head, the assistant there, Chris Barnacote is his name. He's in Maine now at, I think, Augusta Country Club. One of his close friends was Craig Currier at Bethpage. And Craig had a dog named Tilly. And I always wanted to have a dog named after the golf course I worked at. So I ended up having a Wilson. But I always wanted a name. I always thought I was going to name my first dog Rainer. I love Seth Rainer. He's my guy. I love his architecture. And I always kind of, I remember golfing with Jim Yance, the old superintendent at Yeamans Hall. And we were playing Long Cove and we were on the 18th hole and he turns around and says, I think it's safe to say that Pete Dye was a modern day Rainer. With some of the angles and the abruptness of some of the bunker faces and certain other things that you can connect between the two. And so I just fell in love with Rainer. And, there's only two of them here in Florida. Mountain Lake is a quiet club. Silva did the work here back in 2002, 2003 and kind of reinstated a lot of the Rainer template stuff and kind of opened the eyes to a lot of golfers and members of how special Rainer really is and the work that he did, because he certainly didn't design nearly the courses that Ross did. There's a small template of holes that or golf courses that Rainer worked on. And we're excited for the future with Gil. He's going to start working on the master plan for us this winter. But an opportunity to be at one of two Rainer courses, in Central Florida. This place just oozes coolness. It's just something about this place that's just cool. It's non-pretentious. The people here know they got something special, but it's not a badge of honor when they are on property here. It's just everything flows here. It's like a step back in time. There's a lot of Gaiman's Hall is simple as a reflection I can make on Mountain Lake, and there's a reason for that. There's a lot of connections between Yeamans and here, and how it was built, and who was behind it at the time, and just an opportunity to be a caretaker for something so cool. Just grabbed me, and I couldn't turn it away. And the more I thought about it for longevity, the more I thought about it for future projects with what they have coming down the pipeline here, and the interest to have an opportunity to work with Gil and his guys about really turning back the clock here and grabbing some of the things that were original here. There's a lot of original photos. There's a lot of original books and stuff here. So there's a lot. They did a really good job of documenting the place, going back almost 100 years now. And just an opportunity to be a caretaker. I think any superintendent that really enjoys architecture wants to be entrusted to be that kind of caretaker. And it grabbed me pretty easy.
Yeah, it's got to be exciting to have new projects to work on. And I imagine, doing the old marsh, that was a big, extensive project, was really mm-hmm. rewarding. And mm-hmm. and to a certain extent, that project work is a break from monotony of just keeping on the same things every day. That project work really allows you new kind of thoughts and ability to do something differently every once in a while.
100%. And that's always the, by the time that I start getting I shouldn't say bored, but a little monotonous with the general maintenance, it's the end of the season. We're starting to aerify and we're starting to make changes and, mow lines or, reconstructing some bunkers or something like that, that just kind of changes our mode. And now going into our fourth aerification, I'm starting to go the other way now. Like, man, I just want to mow some grass for one of these days to be nice. But I think that's the cool thing, that some of these clubs that work with architects that understand what they have and continue to put it in the capital investments, to continually enhance things and continue to make improvements are really, as a superintendent, it's awesome to be part of. It expands kind of our knowledge, makes us, puts more tools in our pockets, if you will. And it all kind of started, Pine Tree was that similar way. When I was there, Ron Force was brought back in. He did the work there in 97. And we brought him back in 2013. He developed a master plan. And every summer that I was there, we pecked away at certain things on the master plan. And then when I went to Old Marsh, obviously we did a major renovation there. But there was already a template of 3, 4, 5 years out. It's subtle things, cart path things. And then here, when Gil does the master plan and how it comes to fruition and little things, I have no doubt that it'll be a very similar program. We dive in, and I don't get the impression it'll be a full kind of blow up. I think it's going to be more things that we work on in time, whether it's bunker adjustments or, teeing grounds, surrounds, and trying to get the tees flatter and mowing patterns, and then hopefully recapture some of the edges, some of the greens and stuff like that, and kind of tie in some of the Rainer stuff a little bit cleaner maybe. And so I think it keeps superintendents driving. I think it allows us to get out of the normal routine, if you will. And it shows our value. I mean, we're superintendents are flexible. We I think the more interest in architecture and construction you can do, the more valuable you are to your employer. And, you know, it again, going back to it, I've been fortunate to be at clubs that understand what they have and want to continue to invest in it and make it better or preserve it, if you will. That was always one thing. A couple of places I worked at are preserving what was the original architectural intent. I mean, and I'm glad to be at another one.
Mountain Lake and the history of golf in Polk County is so interesting, just from the standpoint of almost every great golden age architect built a course down there. And obviously, yeah. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of them have either been lost or just shells of what they are. But Mountain Lake, like it showcases why it became such a hotbed for design in the golden age, is that unbelievable topography and just, you know, pure sand. And it could be another place where you have, you know, a resurgence maybe eventually of great golf.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because my family, we had a place in Sarasota. So we went to Lakeland a lot as kids, watched the Detroit Tigers play baseball in the spring. And I'd only driven through this area once or twice when I came to South Florida from Colonial back in 2009. And the difference from that time period to today, 10, 12 years later, completely different area. And while some may still think it's you know, kind of off the beaten path, if you will, it is much more populated than what it was. And I think you're going to see Lakeland still extend. I think you're going to see Orlando continue to go south, and which is good for us. I think you're going to keep picking up, you know, members here and there, non-residents to start. And those that really want to be centrally located, but want to be at just a really cool club that is not, you know, not your Orlando kind of club and not a Tampa club. That, and no knock on those, I got good friends and there's some great golf course in the area, but Mountain Lake's just a different place where it just reeks of coolness, and it's hard to describe.
So tell us about how you got into Golf Club Atlas in the early days. I'm very curious about how you stumbled upon that.
You know, Golf Club Atlas is a, you know, like every great club, they go through changes, and some of the reasons that people go, you know, become a member at X club, they think it changes and they end up leaving. And Golf Club Atlas is different than it was. I'm dating myself here, almost 20 years ago, but that's not a bad thing. You know, I think it was kind of, when you said Golf Club Atlas, you know, you either knew about Golf Club Atlas or you didn't know anything about Golf Club Atlas. And I think the coolness about it way back in the day was that was the intention. You didn't, you know, it was a little cult, if you will, like, you know, something you don't tell your wife about and you go talk to your boys about. And, I got turned on to it kind of shortly after I went to Michigan State. I remember kind of by accident, and it just kind of suited me to, I'm hours and hours on that website, learn about golf courses. And, that was back in the day of Gibb and, Tom Paul, when they were, you know, very, very, involved, contributors. Tommy was on there a lot. You know, where 1500 members, that was it. You really had to kind of go through the ringer to even get accepted and get a password from Ran or even John at the time. And, so, you know, that kind of opened my eyes, and in hindsight, I owe a lot of people I met on there, helped me out along the way, giving me information about golf courses that I was interested in learning more about. Certainly, you know, helped me out with Friar's Head because, you know, they're just people that have always been willing to give out information of, hey, you got to call this person, or, you know, I'll gladly host you if you're ever in town. You know, that those sorts of things that long before social media and Twitter and Instagram, some of these other platforms came available, that was just a great avenue for meeting people and having doors opened about architecture and golf courses and not necessarily access in the sense of like, I'm in town, I want to play golf, but just, you know, tell me about the bones of the place. Tell me about the, you know, they're looking for an assistant. What's the problem? You know, can you put me in contact with the superintendent? What, you know, certain little things like that, that just, long before the simplicity of social media, that it is now. And, I still check every day. I don't participate nearly as much in, on Golf Club Atlas as I once did, I don't have the time anymore. I got a 2.5-year-old daughter and new job and those sorts of things. But, I certainly wouldn't know nearly what I think I know about architecture, if it wasn't for Golf Club Atlas.
Yeah. I was a kid that used to, I never was a member. I would just read the message board as like, I was in college and, you know, so I was such a cool guy.
I'm pretty sure my grades in college could have been much better if I didn't have hours and hours on GCA. While I was at Michigan State, I have no doubt that absorbed a lot of my study time.
It was really the first where the sharing and spreading of information, which is, yeah, you know, incredible. You still go on there. I was looking for a map the other day, and they have that great thread of all the routing maps on there.
Yeah.
That like, yeah, you know, you and I hadn't found it, but I was only, you know, 10 pages of a 70 thread thing with all these old routing maps. And in the process, I clicked and saved like 6 other ones, you know.
And it's always cool. Every once in a while, you'll see a thread come up that, you know, dates back to 2006 or 2004 or something like that. And then you come across something that you personally wrote back then. You're like, oh my gosh, what an idiot. I wish I could delete that. And I, you know, just, but it's just really cool how, you know, so much is there. And now it's, you know, it's borderline a household name, when it comes to golf course websites and architectural websites. I don't really know of one that I would put on the same pedestal as Golf Club Atlas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tremendous resource. And, you know, you don't necessarily want to wade into that discussion board all that much, you know.
you got to be prepared to put a bulletproof vest on now. Back in the day, it was a little more, more informative in a sense of we were all kind of learning. And now it's, you know, you spell FAZ on a discussion board and you're gonna get drug over the coals and you didn't even finish it with an I and an O and someone's ready to go after you.
Yeah. It's but the information is just out of this world. And that's, yes, you know, the people that have spent so much time contributing to it, If I was a superintendent at, you know, I took a job somewhere, the first thing I'd probably do would be to search that to see what historical anecdotes that people have posted over the years there.
I would be lying if Mountain Lake wasn't typed in the search function, probably within the hour of me finding out this position was available, just to see recent photos or who says what about. I always knew it was a special place. And but I'd be lying too. As much as I thought I knew about architecture, I didn't know about Mountain Lake when I moved to Florida in '09. I came here from Texas. So I didn't know about Mountain Lake then. And, so over the years being in Florida and seeing rankings and, you know, trying to understand Rainer a little bit more and other golden age architects, that search function became real, real handy for me, and especially even just researching the position here and, you know, the understanding the template holes and what hole numbers were what. That search function probably in the first hour was used for Mountain Lake.
What's been the coolest thing that you've learned about Mountain Lake since you've been there or during the process of interviewing?
The coolest thing is there, you know, the membership here is, when they sincerely ask you how you're doing. It's not a in passing question. There's really good people here, and you know, it's easy for an employee, if you will, to say that about any, to be politically correct, but there's a genuine, I've had a member offer up their cottage for me since I took the position here, while my family and I've, you know, are looking at houses from Palm Beach. And, you know, there's just a general, really sincere, membership here that understands what they have. They don't want to change a lot of the stuff here. You know, they want to make it better, but there's a certain vibe that this place has that they don't want to change that. And when you look at ultra modern this and ultra extreme here, it's nothing about Mountain Lake that's that way. They're very comfortable in who they are. They're very proud of who they are. And it's just a very, it's just a very cool place to be a part of. You know, the architectural part, you know, they're members at other clubs up north and North Carolina and Connecticut and none of them come from a specific type of club that you would go, oh yeah, that's a Mountain Lake member over there. They come from everywhere up north, but they all come here and have a similar interest in this place. And it's a big property. It's expansive property surrounded by orange groves, and there's not a lot of houses here. There's 115, 120 houses here. So for the size of the property, it's not a lot of houses. It's spaced out really well, so it doesn't feel like you're on top of each other. But you know, the simplicity and the coolness of the architecture, I know I keep saying that word, it's just unlike anything in Florida. It's different than the Everglades. I think the coolest thing here is all the money, time and effort that we put into raising everything, at Old Marsh. The first week I was here, we took 2.5 inches of rain in one afternoon. And my first thought was, oh man, we're going to be carts only tomorrow. And the assistant here told me, he's like, nah, we're fine. Don't worry about it. And we mowed fairways the next day, and I was like, I can get used to this. Yeah. This is nice. This is really great. And, you know, just things like that that you don't think about sometimes that just enhance this place. And not to take it out of the, you know, there's just not a bad day here. I have a hard time imagining being a member at Mountain Lake. There's a bad day. It's just a step back in time. It's really awesome.
You make it accomplish one of my dreams is that I really want to just, when it's just monsooning out, go sit at a Rainer punch bowl and watch it drain.
It's amazing. It is. I mean, we've taken some heavy, heavy hitters. I mean, it rained 2 inches in about an hour on Sunday night, and I'm here by the 13th green, and 13th green looked like the pond by 7 green. And an hour later, I could hardly tell it rained. The place drains fantastic. It's just, and we mowed fairways and rough the next day, and we hardly think about it anymore. It's great coming from a place in the marsh and to hear. It's certainly a good problem to have, if you will.
Amazing story. I was with Kyle Franz, who's doing the restoration work at Country Club of Charleston now. Yeah. And he was telling me he was building a practice green, and obviously they're kind of in a tidal marsh and they have flooding issues. It's very low, set right on the marsh level. And he was building this practice green, and he was thinking, like, I don't know how high I should build this thing. And he just went over and he looked at the nearest Rainer green, and he saw the height that the Rainer built it. And he's like, you know what? That's probably the right height. And So he built it the right height. Sure enough, they have a crazy historic flood, and his practice green is perfect. You know, did not get covered in water at all. And it's because Rainer the guy was an engineering genius.
Yes. Yes, built it out of the water line, you know, and it's interesting. I one of the last places I visited before I left Long Cove for Colonial is when Silva was doing the work at Country Club of Charleston back in, I guess it'd be 07 now. And just how flat that property was, but yet all these little blurps, all these little blurps of bunker noses and greens. And you just kind of look at it and go, if they ever got a king tide or if they ever had a, you know, a cat one hurricane, it probably wouldn't, unlike, you know, what happened to Lost Dunes over the years and what they struggled with at Keough Island, you know, it, all those features would still be probably have their necks out of the water yet. And that, it makes sense. You know, you look at Rainer 100 years ago and it's got to be part of the reason he did it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's genius. So we'll get you out of here. We need one Kyle Hegland story since you guys were roommates in college. Obviously, I've former podcast guest, hopefully a future podcast guest for round two, but I need a little Kyle Hegland ammo.
So he became his first year at Michigan State. He became close friends with Keith Krause.
I know Keith quite well.
You know Keith?
Okay. Oh yeah. Well, he's in Chicago with me.
He's a Chicagoland guy. So his family had a summer home. I believe this is how it is. His family had a summer home up by Crystal Downs. And Keith ended up interning for Mike Morris up there. And the first, second, third weekend back, our second year, Kyle went up there. And, you know, everything was the downs, the downs, the downs, the downs, the downs. And I think it just stirred Kyle's emotions about architecture. He had already worked at Austin Golf Club for Doug Peterson at the time and got to meet Ben. And they talked about the downs and the downs and downs. And Kyle was my actual roommate at school. And so we had both had that connection that we had worked at Coor Crenshaw courses for our internships. And I want to say he was either reading the Riviera book or the Donald Ross book. And I remember him crystal clear saying, someday I want to be the superintendent of Sand Hills. And my first thought was like, man, I know you're from Wisconsin and everything, but you know where Mullen, Nebraska is? Like, that is, it's got to be a mile marker, and it's got to be 60 yards or 60 miles to the nearest Walmart. I mean, there's nothing out there. And, you know, lo and behold, he did his time at Austin Golf Club and whatnot. And I remember the day I had heard he got the position at Sand Hills, man, it's 10 years ago now, maybe something like that. And I just kind of chuckled to myself because that was his dream. He wanted to be there and he's done awesome stuff since then. He followed a great lineage of superintendents that have done good work there and left a pretty good plate for him to work on. But his love for architecture, that whole Alistair McKenzie, Crystal Downs lineage to Sand Hills, and it really sparked, I think it really enhanced his interest in architecture. And from then there, him and I have always had an interest in architecture. And we spent, I can't remember, we both took the architecture class taught by a Jerry Matthews associate. And I remember us both, we designed kind of black.
There's an architecture class at Michigan State?
There was, yeah. Our second year,
to take that
first semester. And I thought that was going to be the best class ever. Like, I'm ready for this. This is what I do. This is what I want to do. I got all these church bulletins to go off of to pull knowledge from. And I remember, I know I did it, and I dare say Kyle did it too. We got docked down for building a blind par four. It was not a perfectly viewed green from the fairway. We built a blind par four where you had to, you know, similar to number five at Old Marsh or something like that. And I remember just thinking, this is the one class where I've been looking forward to for a year. And I spent so much time on the draws, and we compared notes, and, you know, we had the squiggly bunkers, the Jeff Bradley-esque kind of bunkers, blowouts and everything. And I remember, I'm confident, I know I didn't get an A in that class, and I'm confident to say he got docked down for not building a perfect template style green with a perfect cookie cutter bunker and a perfect, you know, a contour cut fairway and all that stuff. And it is what it is, but I think that time together enhanced our interest in architecture tremendously, and I think, you know, Kyle's done some awesome stuff at Sand Hills, and it's cool to see, you know, some of the cool stuff and some of the guys that he's worked with that have come through there, and you know, how much of a hard head he was in school sometimes, and the guy just gets it. He's fantastic.
It's you know, ties the conversation perfectly back, because I think you just explained the difference between Jerry Matthews architecture and Mike DeVries architecture in the process.
Yeah, I'll connect those final two dots there. That's I remember being so hurt when I got my grade back. I was so hurt, but oh well, I got over it pretty quickly.
I, you know, grading architecture would be extremely difficult.
Yeah, I'm like, who are you to grade my architecture?
I mean, that's
all good.
All right. Well, hey, this has been fun. I will have to do a part two someday, hopefully in better times where we can do it in person and
sure,
you know, maybe over a beer. But I really appreciate the time. Congratulations on the new job, and I can't wait to see what you guys do down there at Mountain Lake. It's one of my favorite places in Florida.
Thank you so much.